With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
It's what I say to people who ask me how to become a political content creator. First of all, I'm not even that good at it. But it's like I have one tool in my box for content creation other than being very, very funny. And that's sincerity. And I say to people like you can't
and being a seven
and being a seven objectively, but being a politics 12.
Savage.
Hey, everybody, I'm Tim Miller.
And I'm Cam Caskey, and this is FY Pod, the show on Bulwark, where we talk about young people stuff and also some other things as well. I'm thrilled today to be joined by my friend Amanda Lippman, who I've known for many years. Amanda runs Run for Something, which makes the incredibly inaccessible effort to run for office something that a lot more people can do. And Amanda, a lot of people are looking to see who's going to step up in the midterms. And you've got some positive updates about it.
I do. So in the last 10 months since...
Wait a minute. Can we hear about... I mean, me and you know Amanda. I know Amanda. I know the Bangs. We go way back. We've all hung before. But like the viewers, could we learn a little bit about... Could you tell the viewers a little bit about you before we get wonky on statistics about, you know, who's running for city council in Pawtucket? Like, it'd be nice to like learn about you a little bit.
That'd be cool. So kind. It's almost as if you do this for a living. I'm Amanda. I'm co-founder and president of Run for Something. Run for Something recruits and supports young, diverse leaders running for local office all across the country. A campaign rat. Worked for Obama, worked for Charlie Crist down in Florida, worked for...
Whoa. I didn't know you were a cuck.
Oh, that's
you
so nice
cuck.
To say.
You're a cuck too? Like me? I didn't know we had that. I didn't know that part of your bio. You cut it off of your normal bio, I think.
I know. I did that when he switched parties. I worked for him in 2014.
He was Republican, ran as a Democrat. Yeah. What did you think about,
what do I think about,
Charlie?
Did
he give you a lot of attention? Did he give you a lot of attention? Or
I think Charlie taught me that anybody can be a member of Congress. Literally.
Interesting. Yeah. I was one of my favorite Charlie Crist stories. I was with my dad's best friend. My dad's not really that into politics. Just as a normal news consumer, but it's not, not a donor to politics or anything. But his best buddy is a big donor down in Florida. And he was talking about being a donor to that very campaign that you are working on. And we were chatting about this over drinks. And I was like, Charlie Crist is gay, right? And my buddy's, my dad's best friend is like, no, he's not gay. And I was like, I don't know. I think he is. Maybe not. I'm sorry. I don't mean to out him. Maybe he's not. I don't know. And his wife, who's a very handsome lady, a very, very beautiful woman, has gone to a lot of fundraisers with him, said, Craig, this is the only candidate that gives you more FaceTime than me. So I don't know what he is, but all I know is he didn't have lingering eyes for me. So anyway, it'll remain a mystery, I guess. Okay, I apologize for interrupting. Go take us down, Charlie Crist rabbit hole. What else did you do?
It was a weird cycle. I'll say that. Working in Florida, it's a weird place to be. Worked for Charlie Crist for a cycle, then moved to New York to work for Hillary in 2015, 2016, and then started Run for Something shortly after that, which was to help give people who wanted to run for office somewhere to go.
Okay, but what kind of high school kid were you? Were you a debate kid? Were you Model UN?
Weed. Volleyball.
I was the high school TV show. I was one of the producers of that. Smoked a bit of weed my senior year, mostly pretty nerdy. Here's a good one. I wasn't a theater kid, but I was a theater critic. I was a high school theater critic, which is maybe the worst version.
You critiqued your high school theater, or you critiqued professional theater?
So there was a program called Cappies. This is like really, you're digging in here.
This
where
is great.
They would send you to go see other high school's shows for free. And then you would have like little conversations afterwards. And then you'd write reviews and then you'd submit them. And the good ones would get published in the local newspaper, which I grew up in the DC suburbs. So I would have like reviews of local high school theater printed in the Washington Post, which I can't imagine they do anymore.
And sometimes the Cappies see a production of Fiddler on the Roof at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School not long before the tragic shooting there. And they see somebody play Muttel Kamsoil, the tailor who married one of Tevye's eldest daughter, Zeitel. And they see him slay Miracle of Miracles, even though he was fucking sick. And they don't nominate him for Best Supporting Actor. And in case you guys couldn't put this together, I played Muttel at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School's production of Fiddler on the Roof. And I was mentioned in several copy reviews. As a matter of fact, the girl who I dated junior to senior year said that the first time she ever had a crush on me was when she saw me as Muttel. And then the Cappy nominations came out, and you know, I was running March for Our Lives, big organization. I had a lot of things on my plate, but I noticed there was this glaring omission of Cameron Caskey for supporting actor. And I thought, okay, rigged. But no, the Cappies just the
anti-Semitism.
Anti-Semitism. They didn't even know about my personal background. They just saw Fiddler on the Roof and said, you know what? We're not even going to give it any nominations.
Were you a harsh critic, Amanda? Sorry. Do you have more of that?
We only have an hour, so I'm just going to cut it there. But believe me, I've got plenty more to say about the matter.
All right. Were you a harsh critic, Amanda?
I would say I was even-handed. I remember an excellent performance of Damn Yankees, which is a great show, and a horrific performance of Children of Eden, I think.
That's a tough one. Lost in the Wilderness is a very hard song. Speaking of which, I was at the Yankees game last night, and I was sitting right in front of a drunk heckler, and I was laughing because the Yankees gave up 5 runs with 0 hits in, I think it was the 6th, and I just couldn't help but laugh because it was like farcically, comically bad baseball. And the guy got so mad at me. And I was like, sir, I'm so sorry. I'm not trying to twist the knife. It's just, come on. But I love New York and I love New Yorkers. Amanda, so we met at a Run for Something fundraiser thrown by the best friend of FY Pod, who has still not appeared on the show and certainly will one day, Teddy Goff. But
was that this week? Was that related to your flirtation for maybe running for NY12?
I don't know what you're talking about. All I know is that New Yorkers are very excited about some huge things. But we met at a Run for Something fundraiser when the country was a very different place. Donald Trump was in his first term, which was rather different from this one. And I'm wondering, you were helping people run for office 5-6 years ago, also longer, but when we met. And you're helping people run for office now. What's shit like? Are people in a positive mood about running for office? Are people hype?
They are, which is weird. So we've had 67,000 people raise their hands this year. It's more in the last 10 months than we did in the entirety of Trump's first term.
Wow. Oh, my God.
It's like it's people who are pissed. They are running locally. They want to talk about housing and childcare and transportation. They want to talk about the issues. They don't see it. And they are fucking furious at Democratic Party leadership.
I understand why exactly Run for Something started. Running for office is extremely expensive. People don't really know how to do it, even when they want to step up for something like a local race for school board and things like that. Can you just walk us through kind of the problem and what you guys offer in terms of a solution?
So historically, candidate recruitment has been done through like gatekeepers, incumbents picking their successors. It used to be done by unions in some places. In the last 10 years, it has been, or 20 years, really, it has been so fully focused on incumbents or party members that have looked for people who can raise money, which has historically meant not young people, not people of color, not women, not LGBTQIA folks. Just like if you weren't a rich, white, straight, white dude, you probably weren't considered a viable candidate. So you weren't asked to run. What we have done is blown open the doors to that and said, if you want to run for office, we want to help you. So you sign up with us at runforwhat.net. You tell us you're thinking about running. We help you figure out how to get on the ballot, how to write a campaign plan, how to get through all of the logistics you need to get through to election day. If you are running in the right kind of race, you're the right age and you've got the right values alignment, we might endorse you. If you do that, We'll help your campaign figure out strategy. We'll do get you discounts for tech tools. We'll recommend you to partners and to funders. We'll get you volunteers. We'll connect you to other candidates. It's a full soup to nuts from I'm thinking about maybe one day possibly running for office all the way through to I've ran, I've won, I'm now a sitting city council member. Now what?
So if you're getting like 67,000 people signing up, how do you filter out the nutcases? Because I'm sure there are so many people like teachers and mothers and people who are so promising and have something so important
podcast
to offer.
Podcast co-hosts and are also throwing their name in the ring.
I don't know what you're talking about. One could call them podcast hosts as well because we have a spinoff channel that's really good. But when you got that many people signing up, like you must have some people who are pretty good on a bunch of the issues, but then kind of maha or something like that. How do you filter out the Looney Tunes?
You know, part of it is the language that we use doesn't always appeal to the Looney Tunes. In our various stages of the pipeline, we have different ways of winnowing it down. So we've got some curriculum where we want to make sure that people like really are aligned on most of the things. The place where we do the firm value screen is the endorsement process that allows us to really ask like, okay, what does it mean for you to be a pro-choice school board candidate running in bumfuck Iowa? What does it mean for you to be a climate change is real city council candidate in Missouri? Like, tell us what this looks like for you and how this shows up in your campaign. And we work in all kinds of races and all kinds of states and places where the way you might run as a pro-gun safety candidate in Alabama is going to be very different than, say, for New York or California. But as long as we're aligned generally on values, we can be pretty flexible in how those show up as policies.
What's your go-to most inspiring story of like, you know, single working mother school board race where Moms for Liberty had a lot of pull, but you guys beat them? Like, do you have the kind of elevator, here's the awesome thing that we did?
So in 2023, we recruited this guy, Justin Douglas, to run for Dauphin County Commission. He's a former pastor who got fired from his congregation for being too welcoming to LGBTQ congregants. He was working as like an Uber driver. He had been a CrossFit athlete, really working with the homeless community there. We were asking people to run for office, and he was like, well, I don't know, I guess maybe me. We got him to get more engaged. He ultimately ran in part on a pro-democracy campaign because the county commission in Dauphin County oversees the election.
So where is Dauphin County?
It's like around Harrisburg. So
okay, Dauphin. Yeah. Dauphin. I thought you were saying dolphin. Like I imagined, you know, kind like of an idyllic dolphin place. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, where little dolphins are.
Harrisburg. Not that idyllic. I mean, Harrisburg. Maybe idyllic. I don't know. Do
not
you find
me. Like, yeah, not for me.
Not for me.
That's not for me. Nothing against Harrisburg. If you love it, that's great. But it's, I wouldn't call it idyllic.
Lovely place for the people who live there, I'm sure.
Sure.
He was able to campaign particularly on the fact that the jail system in the community had, which is overseen by the county commission, had a bunch of prisoners die in their care. So he had ran billboards around the county, like naming the prisoners who had died and asking who was going to hold them accountable. He ultimately was able to win in 2023 by about 150 votes or so. Flipping control of the county commission for the first time in over 100 years, proceeded to then reform the way that they oversaw the jails, expand access to the polls. He just this week announced he's running for Congress, which is really exciting. He's a very cool guy who's got like huge gauged ears, tattoos all over his body, and like is so in touch with the community, has been fighting corruption since he's took office. Exactly the kind of
who's
person
he running for Congress against.
It's Scott Perry, I believe.
Oh, it's Scott Perry's district.
Yeah.
That'll be a big race. There are people trying to recruit Sarah Longwell into that race, but unfortunately she is too busy of a job running a burgeoning media company. What I want to vibe out with you on a little bit about this recruitment, and we've talked before about, and we can do it this more, just about like the importance of like running in weird places and how people, you never know what can happen, particularly in a wave year. So we could do that too. But I'm more interested right now in your take on like, what kind of qualities are we going for in a candidate? Yeah. Because I feel like, you know, in 2003, you know, if you're recruiting, if you had your organization, you're recruiting Democrats, you're kind of like, we want somebody that was like the head of the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah.
And, you know, like somebody that was a community leader that, maybe he's a little nerdy and like cares about policy and what, and those are all, is on a lot of boards. Like those are, that's fine still for that type of person. But I kind of feel like in this day and age, like there's a little bit of the Democrats a little bit misaligned by doing too much credential diving, you know, and they have too many candidates who are like very well credentialed on the traditional credential marks, but don't do as well on like types of things you have to do now to run for office, whether that be social media or you know, spitballing with us or whatever. What, like, how do you think about that when you're talking to people?
I think broadly speaking, you want people who have really strong values. So like, you need to know what you believe and why, because you need to be able to show up in places like this and have honest conversations about it and sort of be able to hold your shape regardless of what gets thrown at you.
You don't want like to tell me what to say. My favorite, my favorite candidate recruitment story where I was on your side was I was, well, I'm humble bragging after Cameron already did. Many candidates wanted me to be their communications director in 2016, which was stupid since my candidate did horrible. Anyway, I had a good brand. But Scott Walker was one of them. And during our first meeting, I was like, so what do you think your big agenda items are going to be? Like, why do you want to do this? And he gave like a terrible answer. And then I followed up and I was like, no, specifically, like, what do you care about? What are you passionate about? And he looks at me and he goes, isn't that what you're supposed to help me with if I hire you? And I was like, no, actually, no. If you're running for president, you're supposed to have things you care about, and then I help you talk about them to the media. But anyway, as you said, that is true at all, especially true for president, but even for city council. It's not great if you come to run for something and you're like, you know what? I just want to run for something. Will you tell me what to be for? That's not great.
No, we like really want people. You got to know the problem you want to solve. You should understand how the office you're running for would give you power to solve it. And you should be able to articulate why voters should want you to win, which is different than why you want to win. You want to win because winning is great and losing sucks. Voters want you to win because you're going to do something for them. Campaign is about like, where do you communicate that? And like what tactics and like, you know, maybe a little bit about massaging the language, but we can't make up that part for you.
It's what I say to people who ask me how to become a political content creator. First of all, I'm not even that good at it. But it's like I have one tool in my box for content creation other than being very, very funny. And that's sincerity. And I say to people like you can't
make a seven
and being a seven objectively, but being a politics 12. But I say to people like, You can't manufacture authenticity. And at the end of the day, you can get away with building a platform, not meaning what you say and saying what you mean for a certain amount of time. But if you want any longevity in your career, and I think this applies to politicians as well, like you can't say, how can I be authentic? How can I appear more authentic? Like you can be authentic by being authentic. And there's just a degree to which you can't pull that out of the void. You know, if you're principled, you're principled. And if you're just doing this for love of the game, it can, you know, you can see a little bit of success, but it's not going to be something substantial. And people see right through that. People see right through the bullshit of Tim. I mean, like, have you faced that in your career? Like just seeing somebody say, how can I seem more sincere?
You actually could fake it for a while. I do think that's one thing. I mean, there's a lot of terrible stuff about our current politics and a lot to complain about the trajectory of things. I do think that there was a period in time where politicians and even media figures were like so insulated from the public, you know, and like they were so, you know, even when I first started in politics, like the advice you give politicians, and you still see some politicians get this advice because they just haven't updated their strategies in 20 years, is like have three talking points. Find three talking points and tell people what those are. And those are the things. And you just repeat them no matter where you go. And then people will know those three things about you. You could kind of make up two of those three things if you want. You know what I mean? There were plenty of inauthentic politicians over the years. We might have mentioned one already at the top of the podcast, right? Like who just makes stuff up and it worked for them. Okay. It just doesn't work anymore. Like people don't.
You can't do a 2-hour podcast if you're full of shit. At least like not consistently over time.
Yeah, you can be full of shit and like, but you have to convince yourself you believe it. It's a George Costanza. Like J.D. Vance is full of shit, by the way. But like he's bought his own bullshit to such a degree, right? Like, but you can't become more authentic.
You have to be a George Costanza.
Yeah, you have to be actually authentic or a psychopath like J.D. Vance. Like those are the two options, right? Yeah. The middle ground is very bad.
And like, I think you have to know how to perform that authenticity, which it feels weird to say, but you are performing a certain amount of authenticity with some boundaries. So like, I think we know those, there's not as many of these, I think, but the politicians where it's like, oh, actually I want to know less about you. Like, I don't be that kind of authentic in front of me. Like you're misunderstanding what you're trying to do here, but you want a politician who can be, understands that part of their role in this moment is like kind of to cultivate a parasocial relationship with their voters.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great segue into what I wanted to talk about next, which is the Mamdani campaign, because you and I were talking about this the other day. I think there were so many lessons people took away from the Mamdani campaign that were not necessarily it. I think that people saw that huge victory and said, oh, this means that we should make everything about social media and doing videos. And of course, the first thing that people across the board have said was focusing on affordability was huge. But I think there's more to it than that. And I think that he definitely had the parasocial effect. I mean, I don't know if you saw the stories about all the people who met their new significant other at the Zoran event. But also, I think sincerity was a huge part of it and authenticity.
Well, how is that possible? Didn't that campaign start 5 months ago? We have Zoran weddings? Or you just mean like boyfriend?
I don't mean wedding necessarily, but I saw a viral tweet.
We know I'm for weddings, which we'll get to. But I was just curious. The timeline I was confused about.
But also, you know, I follow Run for Something, and I saw a post on Run for Something about how many people signed up just watching that victory. Yeah. And I'm curious, like when you talk to people about the lessons to learn from the NYC mayoral primary, what do you think the key ones are?
Values first, voters first. Like it wasn't really about him. It was about what people were going to get if he won, which I think, you know, back to my previous points, like we're going to get freeze the rent for many people, ideally free childcare, fast buses. I can picture what that looks like in my life as a New Yorker. I think that's really powerful. I think the content was compelling, but mostly I think it treated people like adults. Like it wasn't silly. It wasn't memes. It was engaging and serious and on the level. And a lot of it was very substantive. I think that helps. I also think it's clear he's very comfortable in front of a camera, which at this point is kind of a qualification for people running for bigger offices, is you need to be, if not naturally telegenic, at least willing to work at it and be good at talking, which is like a silly thing to say as a qualification for a politician these days. But we've had politicians who weren't, and you see how that goes. See Biden 2020 to 2024. And I think that he was really committed to matching the online with the offline. Like my door got knocked every 3 days for 6 weeks leading up to the campaign. Now you can only do that with a candidate who can drive organic interest and volunteer support. So those things sort of connect as a circle. I think that's the lesson to take.
Can I go back to you said something that was like really insightful that I think gets missed on all this, which is the, you know, that the voters first over himself, like in his bio, because there's like a cheat code way to do this that some politicians should do, which is very much bio first. Mm-hmm. But like, I'm demonstrating that I care about you. You should know that because I was a working class person and I was a mechanic or whatever. I was a single mother. And like, that's cool. Like people, bio first candidates should do that, right? Like that is a good way to signal people. But he didn't really do that. I bet like if you polled Zoran stands in town and were just like, hey, like, what was his job before this? Like, and what was, you know what I mean? Like, they know some stuff about him, right? Like, he would not run like a bio-focused campaign, really, at all. And I think that is, and the fact that he could demonstrate that he cares about people, that he cares about the things that they care about, and that they could feel comfortable with him without him doing the Zoran, you know, won the whatever community service award. You know what I mean? Like that, the way that people like fall back on to do that is bio, and I think that's like, I mean, A, it shows how good of a candidate he was, but also that's like something other people think about, you know, when they're.
I think
talking
it's like
this.
The most important thing about being a leader, really, like politician, business leader, whatever, is like it's actually not about you; it's about the people you're leading. And if you can remember that and recenter that, it requires a little bit putting ego aside, which can be very hard for many politicians. Yeah. But when you do that and you do it well, which he did, it makes it so much bigger and it makes it so more people can see themselves as a part of it. I think that like, that's a thing you see that now with the candidates that go viral or that make it compelling. It's not about their personal stuff. It's about the way that they make you feel.
And I think, you know, there's a potential candidate for NY12 that I'm hearing so many smart people talk about where one of the
Jack Schlossberg is really good at this.
One of the questions people ask is like, what are the qualifications? And to me, I'm like, okay, well, how are the qualified people doing right now in the fight against authoritarianism? Like, how are the people with the Wharton School of Business degree and the 20 years as a business owner? Like, are you satisfied with the opposition that they're presenting to Donald Trump? I think that the one of the first things that Cuomo was memeing about with Zoran was like, he's never worked a real job in his life, which is something that's interesting to say about someone who is a state assemblyman. But it just, it brings to mind, like, you know, when you're talking to a teacher who wants to run for school board, or when you're talking to someone who is insecure about the fact that they haven't necessarily looked like a traditional politician, is that the message? Like, it's not necessarily about the bio. It's about what you're putting forward.
Here's a prime example of that. Can I just to put a finer point on it, because we talked about the Maine Senate race. I don't know if either of them are your candidates, but like there was all this discussion like a month ago about how Maine, in like an insider Democratic circles, like, we need to get Janet Mills in, the governor of Maine. I have nothing against one way or the other. She seems like a fine governor. I don't pay that close of attention to Maine. But like, she also is very much a politician. She's the governor, she has a politician-y vibe. And like, since then, we've had the oyster guy, Graham Plattner. I keep saying planter, and several people are correcting me. So I'm doing my best. Plattner, it's just a little slight dyslexia. But Graham Plattner, the oyster guy, I'm sure people have seen. There's been another guy who jumped in who owns the Maine beer company. Dan Kleben is his name. And both of them, I don't know. For me, it's kind of like, I kind of would like either of them better than Janet Mills, I think. I who knows? Like, we'll see how the campaign goes. Maybe they'll turn out to be weird or freaks or like not that good at campaigning. But like, in theory, right? I mean, isn't that kind of what people... I don't know. I feel like sometimes people who don't have traditional backgrounds might be discouraged to run, but I feel like it should be, in this moment in particular, the opposite.
I think that's exactly right. And that's what we're doing is, you know, you do not have to have experience as a politician. You do not need to have a poli sci degree. You don't need to be a lawyer. You don't need to be rich. There's some, like, you need to care. You need to be willing to do the work. You cannot be lazy. You, like, man, this is actually my bigger flag with Janet Mills beyond her sort of like positioning, is that a candidate you have to beg and plead to run is not going to be a good candidate, because it's not fun enough. It's hard as shit to run for office.
No, old guy joke. It's like Fred Thompson, the presidential campaign savior. You know, it's going to be all begged him to run, and then he like didn't. Yeah,
you know, you're not going to do it. It's not that fun. So no. I think that is like actually my bigger flag for most of this. But we want people who can communicate like normies. And sometimes that means you want the normie to run. Normie, like, complimentary.
Yeah.
It's good. It's good to be a normal person who just cares enough to do what is very earnestly like an extraordinary thing of putting your name on the ballot and being willing to be brave enough and to love the place you live enough to want to fight for it. I think that's beautiful.
If I'm going to hypothetically run for office, I should probably stop using the words trepidatious and ostensibly. But I
can only be who we are, dude. Can only be who we are.
Ostensibly is a good word. I don't know if trepidatious is a word, actually.
Trepidatious is a word. Yeah, it means like
trepidation.
I don't think it's the same thing as lily livered, which is also not a word you should use. But I think they're in the same family of words. It means cautious, perhaps a little bit concerned. That's right, Amanda.
Apprehensive.
Right?
Yeah, trepidatious. I mean, trepidation. I use. So there you go. Yeah, probably you shouldn't use trepidatious. But here's a question I have for you on recruiting these people that's centrist pilled. Okay. Because I hear from some former Republican types or pro-democracy that want to run and want to get out there, and particularly in red states. And I've had some feedback recently from a couple of them that, what's the right word? I don't know if scared is the right word, but they're a little intimidated about the idea of, they have a couple of views maybe that are not fully in line with the party, right? Like on everything. I mean, generally they're anti-Trump and they're whatever. Like they have a lot of pro-democracy and they have, you know, generally, you know, liberal social values. So maybe not every single issue, you know, down the line, right? Progressive, right? And they're like, I get in. The first thing I do is I go to Democratic committee meetings in my town or city, and the people there like browbeat me over their random lefty policy platforms. And I don't know, like, do I, you know, and it's like, oh, like I either fight with them, which is like a bad start, or I'm not true to myself and I kind of fudge and like go along with the platform. And I, you know, I don't know. My advice to them is kind of like, particularly if you're running in a, you know, red state, this probably won't work if you're running for mayor of New York, for example. Shout out Whitney Tilson. But if you're running in a red state, like, just do it. Be yourself. Maybe don't like worry about the committee people. Maybe do other stuff. Do social media. Go to other community meetings. But maybe I'm being a little naive about that. I don't know. I'm sure you hear this from people, and maybe even on the left who have views out of step, or any, you know, people who have out of views out of step with like the mainstream. How do you talk to them?
You know, encourage them to one is when you're thinking about like the establishment or institutions, like they don't have that much power anymore. It doesn't really matter. I mean, it's like good to, you know, be friendly. Don't be antagonistic unless it helps you maybe to be antagonistic in that place. But like, you know your community better than probably the Democratic Club does in a lot of these places, or the party institutions do. And so I think being respectful, but also not backing down from your strongly held values. And I think being able to connect why your position is right for the race you're running in. Like, if you are a Republican run, or not former Republican, I should say, running, wanting to run as a Democrat in a place because you, the party, as you know, as Charlie Crist, you say, I didn't leave the party left me. Like, you want to serve this place that you live, and the Democratic Party brand right now is the right place for you to do it. There's probably a lot of your neighbors who feel the same way. You can probably speak to them better than some of the like longtime Democrats in that area can. I think lean into who you are. Don't be afraid to stand in that, but also make sure that people get to know you as a person, because often they don't have to agree with you on every policy to like you and vote for you.
Right.
It's weird that like be a likable human being is advice here, but that is kind of the shtick.
Yeah. Is that true even in like local stuff? Like where people don't get to know people as well?
Well, I think they actually do get to know you really well because you see them at the grocery store, at the gym, at the soccer games, at the PTA meetings. Like, you can really have that in-person relationship that can help overcome the like direct mail bullshit. Because like, if I'm going to get the direct mail that tells me that this person is the devil because they believe XYZ thing, well, I've met them. They've come to my house. We had iced tea. We talked about property taxes. Like, I don't agree with them on anything, but I like them and know them. I think that helps sort of inoculate you.
What attack that your candidates get do you think is the cheapest and weakest, but also most effective in a campaign? Like when somebody's going after someone you really like and they use something and voters actually kind of respond to that and then they start asking questions, what do you think is the most unfair attack on another candidate that is just not worth it?
I think there's a bunch of not as much in New York, but we get a lot of like, they're a renter. They don't own property.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That's insane.
I think it's like, we don't have freeholder shit anymore. You don't have to own property to have a say in where the community is. But this idea, it's sort of like coded language that implies, right? It's coded language that sort of implies they're like transient or not welcome, or like, you know, it's like weird nativist shit. It's very bizarre, but it's the kind of thing we've heard candidates say. It's one of the reasons we're doing like a campaign to get more renters to run for office. One, because the housing market is collapsing, but two, it is a kind of stigmatization of a whole group of people that feels so unmoored from how especially young people live.
He's not a landowner. He shouldn't run for office. Sounds like something straight out of the 1700s.
Well, it's like he's not committed. He doesn't have a say in the future. He doesn't have a stake here. You know.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. If people in my generation are going to start running for office, which a lot of people are calling for, I think you're going to see you're gonna be hard pressed to find one who owns property, seeing as I think one of the definitive traits of what it means to be in Gen Z right now is being a renter, and that's if you don't live with your parents, which I've seen statistics that say over 50% of us are doing right now. So hopefully that goes away with time. I wanted to talk about young people running. This is another thing we've discussed offline, because I see certain young people make being young a central part of their campaign. And I think that it's great to see young people running for office, but I also think it's a little questionable how much credibility being young gives you. I also think people will use somebody's youth as an attack on them. Whereas I personally am like, well, where are you on the issues? But what have you seen with that?
I think it is in and of itself not a credentialing. It's what that does to inform your lived experience. Like, to your point, you're younger, you probably don't own a home. I think you're at a different stage of your career. You're thinking about your family planning. You're thinking like you've had different relationship to higher education, different relationship to schools. That is what makes it compelling. It's not just the age. It's like the way that affects your lived reality and the prioritization you would give to particular issues in office. I think where candidates get messed up is they don't finish the sentence of like, it's not that I'm young. It's that I'm young and therefore I'm thinking about how to start a family and I can't afford to live where I want to live and raise kids where I want to raise kids if that's something I want to do.
Sure.
And that's why
we're getting to that.
Like, that's, you got to finish the sentence.
Yeah, I have a question about young people running. like I said, I have two that are both related to social media. To me, I bet one of the things that has people hesitant about running is their social media archive, let's call it. Let's just start with that. Like, does that matter anymore even? Maybe the answer is yeah. I kind of think I want to say no because it doesn't matter for the president, but maybe it does matter in local places.
Do you remember the Free Press video that they made where they were like, I just read every Zoram Mamdani tweet. Here's what we found.
Yeah, it didn't affect him at all. He did have some really bad tweets from 2019, but not everybody's Zoran. I mean, not like bad, like dick pics or whatever. Bad, just like getting rid of all police is queer liberation or whatever. Like he had very of the moment political tweets.
But let's play the Free Press video right now.
I read every tweet that Zoran Mamdani has ever posted, and there are 16,000 of them. I've watched and listened to every interview he's ever done, and I found his secret Instagram account that I think he's forgotten about, where his profile picture is this. I've cold called his former classmates, teachers, and co-members of Students for Justice in Palestine. And no, it's not stalking, it's called journalism. And what have I discovered from all this sleuthing? Mamdani is much more radical than his new polished campaign is painting him out to be. Here are some examples in his own words taken from his Twitter. He's a socialist. He wants to defund the police and abolish medical bills. And capitalism is theft. And he once suggested taking apartments from rich people and giving them to the homeless. And of course, he believes the government should provide free housing for all.
All right, you've seen them now.
Yeah.
What about people who don't have Zoran's charm, maybe, and have a similar archive, but maybe even worse, maybe some personal behavior that isn't quite perfect?
You know, there's certainly things that might be disqualifying, like the lieutenant governor candidate in South Carolina last year. Who was going on the weird porn forums.
What's
his name? Mark.
Mark Robinson.
Mark Robinson. Thank you.
Wait, this is news to me. What?
You didn't know about the Nazi porn? He would bring a pizza into the back of the porn shop, and then he was a KKK. What was his? He was a Nazi, black Nazi.
I remember the black Nazi, yeah.
What was it called? Something like that. Anyway, go ahead.
But like, that's kind of how bad it has to be to matter, you know? Yeah. If it's not that bad, especially for folks who are a little bit younger, where like, I don't know about you guys, but like I've been online, I've had a screen name since I was 6 years old. I was probably on MySpace when I was like 10, 11, Facebook since high school.
Do you remember that MySpace had us rank our friends?
Oh yeah, that was savage shit.
That was savage. That was like, this is why the millennials, this is why we have that dog in us. This is why we're built for the fire, like nobody else, because we had friend rankings.
I missed MySpace by a couple of years. I had AIM, was huge for me.
Did you have like careful cultivation of your away message and your profile?
That I don't completely remember because I do think I was 8. I had Facebook when I was 8 because, you know, they said you had to be 13 to sign up. So I just told that I was 13. But that was because I wanted to play Facebook games. Do you remember Facebook games like Farmville?
Farmville.
I don't know the last time I thought about Farmville. I remember.
People on Facebook?
Were you on Farmville,
no, I didn't.
Tim?
Farmville? Come on. I
don't know.
I was partying.
My step grandma. It was like the way that I stayed in touch with my step grandma for several years after the Farmville era was she would just send me a request for crops. And I was like, okay. And I think that more people should be playing Farmville right now because the crisis we're facing in the Midwest with AI data centers sucking up water from the ground.
Chinese aren't buying our soybeans anymore. Yeah.
It's a real concern. And I think that maybe making a pro farmers Farmville resurgence would be positive for Democrats running in the Midwest. But we could talk about that another time. Amanda,
I didn't get to Amanda. I just wanted to, like, do you advise them to delete, though? I guess that's my question. Are we scrubbing? Are we scrubbing or not scrubbing?
Go through your archives, know what's out there. Scrub if you think there's something really, but like people will find it. So it doesn't really matter if you scrub. But like you should know what's out there. Have a good, do a little self-oppo.
Here's my other social media, which is thing for new candidates, which I think is young and old. Something I'm a little bit, I'm like vaguely engaged in the mayor's race down here in New Orleans. I am not endorsing anyone. I have my do have a friend from my kid's school that's one of the candidates, and there are a couple of good candidates. Local races are fucking savage now. Mm-hmm. I haven't been involved in a local race in a long time, and it used to be like there would be mean things in like the comment section under newspapers, but now because of social media, I mean, people are dropping bombs about each other, like on Instagram comment sections, doing selfie videos. I'm like, this race is insane. I mean, it literally.
Like, can you give me an example?
Yeah. I mean, there are accusations of infidelity happening in people's comment feeds, or people doing like just selfie videos. That, like, you know, that they're pretending like they're journalists, but they're not really. And who knows if they're like there's one guy that I'm pretty sure is basically just a paid surrogate for one of the mayor's candidates, but he like presents like he's an independent content creator, and he's out there doing news reports about the other person that just feels like an Oppo research book that has like vague. I don't know. Maybe it's true. Some of the things seem not that true. I just, it's kind of the Wild West out there right now. How do you talk to people about that? That to me almost feels like the most intimidating thing about getting in right now.
Well, it's like, you got to know what's out there. You got to know what people are going to say about you. Same kind of prep you would do for any campaign, but also like, think about your friends and your family and how they're going to engage. And like, can you cultivate a pretty good network of people who will be your online keyboard warriors on your behalf, like especially the local social groups. Like, I don't know about you, Tim, but I'm in all kinds of WhatsApp and group chats for like parenting and school stuff. And it is.
My husband does that.
That's good marriage. I'm the correspondence manager in our marriage. And so it's a lot of shit people drop in there. They're lobbing bombs. And it's. Dude. It nice gets door. Messy. And I think it's also like making sure that you know what those spaces are so that you can network them appropriately.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's hard. It has me freaked. Like, you people are out there.
Well, and I think like this is to your point of like, what are we looking for in candidates right now? You have to have a tough skin, because especially the more low you get, it's going to get real personal. It's going to get nasty. It's because its stakes are high.
Yeah. Let's go back to uplifting. We're already convincing people not to run. They're listening. What about give us some more happy stories, particularly coming up in this midterm. Let's go back to what I mentioned at the start. I'll say this. In 20, what would it have been? 18, a bunch of Democrats got swept in that would not have otherwise, just because it was a wave year. Like, this happens. And then in 26, back when I was still a Republican in 06, that was like the year that, like, remember when Mark Foley was diddling pages and Katrina and trapping the Rock was a disaster. Like, some weird Democrats won elections that year. I remember I was working in Iowa, and this guy that nobody's even paying attention to the race because it wasn't even on anybody's radar, and he's like a local professor running against a 30-year incumbent. He ended up being in Congress for 10 years after that, right? So you just, weird things happen in wave years. So talk about like where you're recruiting people and what might opportunities be that would be even better than in another environment.
You know, we're thinking right now really, really broadly. So can we make sure we have really great candidates running in all of these places where like the new congressional maps are going to create newly competitive districts, perhaps, or surprisingly competitive districts, like in Texas, in Missouri, in Indiana, especially on the state and local level? Where can we ensure we have really good candidates that can generate reverse coattails up ticket? Similarly, Ohio, where can we get really good folks on the ballot for city councils and school boards so that Sherrod Brown has a really strong sort of army of local folks running and leading? I'm looking also thinking about long-term work in Utah, in Idaho, in Nebraska, because not just for 2026, but 2028, and especially post-redistricting 2030 and 2032, especially, we're going to be able to have to at least try to win in some of these places. So right now is the moment where we blow up the map so that 6 or 8 years from now, we can reconsolidate and reevaluate where the competitive places are.
Do you have any cool, like, unexpected type candidates, like, also on that front? Like, I don't know, somebody jumps out, they're like, oh man, like, I don't know, they were a truck driver, or they were, I don't know, saved a child from the bottom of a well.
We just have, oh my God, it's like asking me what's my favorite book, and I've never read a book in my life. I will tell you, I'm really excited about this. She's not like an unusual woman, but this young woman, Lily Franklin, is running for a state house in Virginia, who this is her second time running. She came within like 200 votes of flipping a state house seat there. Super rural area. This time around, it's going to be one of the most competitive in the state. She's like long time of the community farmer. Very cool. He's like a very cute dog that you post about on social all the time. I'm just really excited. I think it's cool when people lose and decide that doesn't discourage them.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we were talking about young people, we were talking about family planning. And on our Monday episode of FY Pod, we were talking about the recent poll or statistics or whatever the fuck that came out about Gen Z women who voted for Harris not prioritizing having children and getting married, and Gen Z men who voted for Trump having children as their top example of what success in life looks like and having emotional stability as literally their bottom example. And, you know, I posted a pretty good clip of Tim and I having a very interesting conversation alongside Bulwark on Instagram. And a lot of people in the comment section were saying, well, why isn't there a woman involved with this conversation? Which is totally reasonable. Although I will say the point that I make in the video is that women prioritizing themselves is a very great thing. So I don't know what these people want from me, but you are a mother.
Well, before we listen to the woman, okay, now that you've bullied us into having a woman on to talk about this, it's on the long list of things people hated me about this week. Do you guys watch The Gilded Age?
No, I have two little kids. I haven't watched TV in 5 years.
Yeah, you have two kids. That's what I'm saying. I'm doing like 5 podcasts. I've got a child. I've got LSU football. And I missed Zohran did that great ad with a guy and who did a great job reading the ad. It was hilarious. It was about the Hamptons people not liking him. Amazing ad. I did a video about that. Apparently, the man doing the thing is in a show, The Gilded Age. I have 120 messages from people about this. I'm like, I got it. Okay, I apologize to people. They were mad at me for saying I didn't think shingles was that big of a deal. Okay, I apologize. I apologize. I throw myself on the mercy of the court. I've never heard of anybody dying from shingles. So I just did it.
You know what? In a world of unoriginality, I've got to hand it to you. I've never heard that one before.
Cameron. So anyway, they're mad at me. I'm just saying, I guess I've got thick skin. Okay, as Amanda Lippman said, it's fine. Be mad at me about my take about Kamala young women, and also, you know, be mad at me about the shingles and the guy from the fucking show that I have to watch. So anyway, thank you for your feedback, commenters. I value it. Amanda, as a woman as a mother, tell me why I'm a sexist pig for thinking that maybe young women should think a little bit, should care a little bit more and value a little bit more family, because this family's nice.
It is nice. I have two little kids. They're very cute. I think it was really interesting. I'm curious because I have a big job. I can say that. Yeah, I have a big job.
You have a big job. You're fucking working.
I know. I've written 2 books, a big job, lots of stuff. And I have 2 little kids. I have an almost 3-year-old and a daughter who'll be almost 1 in like 2 weeks. And I would never have said that having kids was the thing that made me successful. So I'm actually really interested in the framing of that question, because it's not like, it is not the idea that it's not, doesn't make your life meaningful or good. It's just that like, that is not what success looks like, in part because that is kind of what's expected of you. Like there's just like some tension there in that frame.
I hear that. And I had other people give that feedback as well and said maybe the poll would be different if the question was, what do you value the most rather than what would make you feel the most successful? Even still, it was like having a mortgage or whatever was higher. And I'm like, okay. I don't think that people should prioritize having a mortgage over a child and their own success. I don't think you can be very successful in rent. I guess my question for you is broadening it out from the poll. And part of the reason why I wanted to talk about this on Monday, even though I knew everyone in the comments would disagree with me, is it's not just this poll, right? Mm-hmm, like, it's not. Like, there's plenty of data points. There's plenty of anecdotes that young people, we can take this out from broaden it out from women, but I'll be interested in your take, particularly on young women. Young people, particularly young liberal progressive people, are not excited about having kids. Mm-hmm. And you hear about young women talking about how the young men are fucking MAGA assholes, which I'm sympathetic to. You hear about price cost, which I'm sympathetic to. You hear about climate, which I agree with is a problem, but I'm a little less sympathetic for that being a reason not to have a child. I'm sure there's some other things I'm not thinking of. So it is, like, regardless of that particular poll, it is a trend.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I worry that like there's a culture of like, it's okay. you know, out there that's like, you focus on you and you worry about you and don't worry about this. It is hard out there and it is, and things are expensive. I don't know. And I just think people, some young people might be getting the wrong message from the culture, particularly on the left. That's what I worry about.
I do too, because I think it is really hard to talk about the good stuff of being a mom without immediately hearing about how you're still doing it wrong. Like, I love being a mom way more than I ever expected. It is one of the most joyful things in my life. I find my daughters deeply delightful and meaningful. I love that my husband is a more than equal partner. He takes great delight in our children. I'm very lucky in all those ways. And also, I kind of feel like it's a privilege that I get to love being a mom because I can afford full-time childcare because I have married well. Like, that feels unfair. And so when I talk about it in public, it's kind of like, well, yeah, of course you like it. You have money. And that's what it's hard. Like, I don't know how you combat that.
That's one of the things about the Trump supporter Zoomer men saying that having kids means success that I think is also them getting the wrong message is I don't think that these guys are all interested in being an equal partner in raising the child. I think a lot of these guys assume that the wife is going to be doing all the work. And that's certainly something I know is a popular opinion among right-wing men is that the mom, the woman's job is to be the mother and to be at home and doing that. But it brings to mind an interesting thing we talked about on our spinoff channel that I'm yet again plugging. I was speaking with my ex-girlfriend, who's a contributor to it, Ellie. We were talking about how a lot of right-wing guys have been looking for liberal women because the conservative women that they meet expect them to be more traditionally successful as men. And a lot of these conservative guys are not able to be a breadwinner and are not able to do that at home. But I definitely think a big reason that young men are saying that having a child means that they're successful is they assume the mom is going to be doing everything and they assume the mom is going to be doing the work and they're not ready to be an equal partner in raising the child.
Yeah, I would interrogate, like, do you want to have kids or do you want to parent children? Because those are two different, like, do you want to be an active parent in your kid's life and like really engage and be present for you? Because that is what ideally having kids is. And I don't think that's what a lot of people understand, at least a lot of younger men understand as their role in this process.
Can I turn you both into the interviewee? Can I step into the interviewer chair and put you both on the spot?
Would love that.
One of the things that I've read so many concerning things about is what teachers are experiencing with parents right now. And a lot of these parents right now are millennials. And I've come to the understanding that parents have been a lot more cruel to teachers. And parents have, I saw this meme that was like 20 years ago when a kid brings an F back home, the parent says, "How could you have let this happen to the kid?" And then today the kid brings an F home and the parent says, "How could you have let this happen to the teacher?" Like, are you guys seeing in your communities of parents, like, are you seeing millennial parents be a little bit more entitled or lazy? And this is coming from a Zoomer, by the way.
Millennials are great. We're the only generation that is at all has our heads screwed on straight and has not had our brains broken by phones or
Fox parents
news,
are going insane.
The parents aren't great. My school, thank God, we have a great school. And a lot of it is because I got really lucky with the parents. And a lot of the parents in our class are really lucky. So I feel blessed by that. But I have a wide network of millennial friends. And so I hear some insane anecdotes, like truly, truly insane.
I know someone who works at a nonprofit that operates kind of like a camp for kids. I don't know, I think it's an arts program.
Yeah, sure.
And a 7-year-old came in with a note from the parents that said, "You cannot say no to this child." That was the note.
That's not parenting.
I know, or anything, or like the phones. The blowback on the phone stuff is so wild. Like schools that try to get the phones out and the parents are like, "Well, I need to text my kid." Parents are like texting their kids in the class about like what they want for dinner and stuff and like how little, like about their own day. And it's
for what it's worth, among like, so my kid's a little younger than yours. Among like my peer group of parents, we're like, who's going to be the first one to break the pack? None of us are getting our kids' phones. until they're 16.
We literally had the phone packed conversation at a kid's birthday party 3 weeks ago. Saying, I was going around to the other parents. It's like, who's drafting it that we could all sign? Because you know,
there's like a window there where there's,
you know, there will be a weak link. But yeah, no, it's not good. My view is, I've said this to the principal at our school, is I was like, if a parent is texting a kid in school about something that is not a family emergency, you should confiscate the parent's device for a week. That would be my policy if I was a principal. I don't know if that's legal under the law, but I feel like the parent should have their phone canceled. So I don't know, man. I guess just circling back to my thing, there are crazy parents in all ages. There are challenges in all ages, right? I know that in particular housing costs a lot right now and childcare costs a lot right now. And so I'm not trying to minimize that, but like there were financial and challenges to raising kids in every generation. There were. And so all I'm saying is I think that understanding and wanting to fix, and this is why we want people to run for something, TM, and wanting to fix the underlying things that make it more expensive are cool and good. But I just wish that we could figure out a way to cultivate like expressing how meaningful and great parenthood is alongside how challenging it is, right? And to say to young people, like, instead of, oh, just get your shit in order and worry about yourself and worry about your mental health and worry about your finances and then figure it out. It's kind of like, well, I don't know. Maybe try to figure it all out together. That's fucking life. You know, that's life. And like, there's value in all of that. And you don't want to have, you don't want to regret the fact that you wanted to make sure that you could, you know, like whatever, sock away an extra couple grand a month over something that's going to mean a lot to you. That's all I'm saying. And it's not for everybody. Yeah. But I don't want people for whom it is for to be like discouraged from it by the culture. That's my take.
There's a particular, as the woman on the conversation.
Yeah, thank you, please.
Do you think there's a particular thing for millennial and Gen Z women where like my mom didn't really have a choice whether she could work or have kids? Like once she had kids, she had to drop out of the workforce.
Right.
Her mom, similarly, 30 something women, generally speaking, we're the first real generational cohort who could decide to do both and actually kind of make it happen, even if it's really fucking hard.
Yeah, right.
10 years beneath me, I'm 35. So if you're 25 right now, whether or not you want to have kids doesn't actually feel like it's a choice you get depending on what state you're in. And your career path maybe feels like kind of messy too. Like it feels like we have gone backwards in many ways.
Yeah, you're a little Goldilocks era. We're a little Goldilocks era. Maybe. There's something to that.
I have a lot of empathy for that because it is really hard to decide like when in your career do you want to have kids? When is the right time? At what point do you decide, you know what, for the next 5 years, I'm going to take at least one or two maternity leaves and throw my entire mental and physical health like through a fucking blender in order to start a family. It is a big decision. And when we can't talk about the joy and the meaning alongside the hardship, it's really hard to see the upside.
Yeah. When the dudes are just vaping and voting for Donald Trump.
Back to the poll, the mm-hmm. Gen Z Women for Harris poll and the Gen Z Men for Trump poll. I know that I very often diverge from my generation on certain things, and I very often am a radical realization of my generation on other things. But I think that like I personally really want to have children, and I want to have children at a young age, when I can comfortably do so and feel like I can provide them the care that they need, because the loss of my grandfather last year made me think a lot more about family. And he had my father when he was very young, and they got to spend so much time together. Unfortunately, there could have been another 15, 20 years there, and that was taken away from us by the terrible, terrible cancer. But I think that the experience that I was able to get with my grandfather, who my parents had me when they were pretty young as well. So I got my grandfather in years where he still had a youth about him, even though he was an older guy, there was still something plucky in him that I don't necessarily know would have been there were there an extra 15 years, you know, in between him and having my parents or whatever. But like, I want to have children at a young age because that loss made family so much more important to me. But I'm going to rate emotional stability first, because that's I need to have that if I'm going to have a child. So I think when it comes to what this poll actually means in terms of priorities, I really want to have kids and I want to be married. I said on this podcast 5 months ago that I want to get married within the next 18 months. And that's still the plan. 13 months until my wedding. Again, I need to figure out to whom it will be, but we're getting there. I don't have anybody yet, but I feel like we're getting there. But I'm just like,
ladies,
I don't know. Like, I think putting your career first, well, we need to be able to pay for having kids, and putting your emotional stability first. There's a certain amount of attention I need to pay to my mental health before I can feel like my kids will have steady parenting. And it's just like, can you have kids if you're not prioritizing your emotional stability?
I will just say, like, there's never a good time. There's only the time you decide to do it and then you figure it out.
Yeah. This is my thing. I don't know. I feel like now we're getting very into Zoomer talk, which is good for this podcast because it's like a Zoomer framing of language. Like, emotional stability is like literally not even a phrase. I don't know about you, Amanda. Like, I don't think anyone in my friend group would have said the phrase emotional stability in college and in my 20s. No. And so it's kind of like there's this therapy talk that is becoming very in vogue now. And I'm pro therapy, by the way. But I just say, like, I don't know, man. Who's emotionally stable? I'm not emotionally stable. I have a kid. I know. Obviously, I'm being a little cheeky, but, like, sure, you shouldn't have a kid if you're deeply emotionally unstable, right? Like, of course, right? But I don't know. It depends what you mean by emotional stability.
Life is
unstable.
We had this conversation 2 days ago, so it was on my mind. And yesterday, I was on the train on the way to the Yankees game because I love New York City, and New York is so important to me, and it's in my priorities.
The Islamabad of America.
The Islamabad of America, the Istanbul of America. but I was on the train, and I saw this Zoomer woman who had a crying child in a stroller. And while this child was crying, she was scrolling through Instagram, and I was like, this is why I think Gen Z people need to get to a certain place, because if my kid was in the stroller crying, that would be my first priority. I would not be on Instagram.
I'm on the side of the mom. Sometimes you just gotta scroll, okay?
Sometimes you just gotta let the kid cry. Their problem is that they're tired and they need to close their eyes, and the only thing you can do is leave them be.
It's sort of like if you give a mouse a cookie thing with attention, where, like, the more attention you give them in that matter, the more incentivized they are to keep crying.
I'm on team mom. Scroll away, ma'am.
Okay.
Now, maybe the commenters will agree with me instead of Cameron on this one. Team mom. All right, that's the show. Slay, everybody. That's Amanda Lippman, our old friend. We appreciate you very much.
And Amanda also has books that we didn't get to talk about. Go check
Buy
out
them.
Google Amanda Lippman book and purchase it.
There you go.
Thanks, everyone.